698 comments on the Xbox story. That number alone tells you something. The short version: Xbox Live went down, and because Microsoft has tied its disk authentication to an always-on license verification system, people who had physical disks, pressed plastic that they purchased, that they hold in their hands, could not launch those games. The server outage essentially revoked their ability to play.
And the reaction on HN was not just frustration, it was philosophical. The top comments weren't people venting about their gaming session being interrupted. They were people carefully articulating the legal and ethical gap between what ownership means in a commercial transaction and what it means in practice when a publisher controls the authentication layer. The framing that kept coming up was, you didn't buy a game, you bought a revocable license that comes in a cardboard box.
From a business standpoint, this is the inevitable endpoint of what the industry has been building toward for about 15 years. Microsoft, Sony, every major platform has been systematically shifting the economics toward digital distribution and subscription services because the margins are significantly better and the resale market disappears. But the disc has always been held up as the consumer's fallback, the thing you could play offline, the thing you could lend to a friend, the thing that didn't evaporate when a service ended. If disc authentication requires a server handshake, that promise collapses entirely.
There's a real legal question underneath this, too. Several commenters pointed out that in many jurisdictions, the sale of a physical good comes with implied warranties about its fitness for purpose. If you sell someone a disc, and the disc cannot play without a server that you control and can turn off, you may have sold them something that doesn't actually function as described. The European Consumer Rights Framework is pretty explicit about this, and we might see this become a test case.
The EU's right to repair movement has been pushing adjacent ground on software. There was a ruling earlier this year about embedded software in products, the principle that consumers shouldn't be stripped of functionality they paid for through remote server decisions. The Xbox situation maps directly onto that argument.
What I find worth watching here is the parallel to the data center NIMBY story, also on HN today. The piece at jasmi.news makes a point that's almost satirical in its accuracy. Communities benefit enormously from the infrastructure of the modern internet, streaming, cloud computing, instant commerce. But when you propose building a data center that actually powers those services in their neighborhood, there's immediate resistance. Noise, heat, water use, visual impact. The through line to Xbox is that people want the capabilities of networked digital services without being exposed to the underlying realities of what sustains those services, which includes infrastructure in physical space and infrastructure that can fail.
The data center piece is scoring relatively low in terms of HN votes, but the argument it's making is genuinely substantive. Data centers are now one of the most contested land use categories in the United States, and the localized opposition creates geographic concentration, which in turn creates exactly the kind of single point of failure risk that the Xbox outage represents.
For the Xbox situation specifically, the immediate practical question is whether Microsoft will implement a proper offline mode for disk authentication, a cryptographic signature embedded on the disk itself that doesn't require a server call. Technically, that's straightforward. Commercially, they have every incentive not to do it, because offline capability reduces platform lock-in. The question is whether regulatory or consumer pressure tips that calculation.
It won't come from good intentions alone. That much is clear.
There's one more thread in this cluster worth pulling: the Waymo Dallas launch, which opened to all riders this week, not just a waitlist. 541 comments. The interesting tension in the HN discussion isn't about whether the technology works. The consensus is that it does, in the specific conditions Waymo deploys in. The debate is about what open to all means when the service area is limited, pricing is unclear, and the regulatory framework governing commercial robotaxi operations still varies block by block in some cities.
The business question with Waymo is always the same. At what scale does the unit economics turn positive? Alphabet has been absorbing the development cost for years. Dallas is a significant market. It's the kind of sprawling, car-dependent metro where a robo-taxi service could theoretically capture substantial ride volume. But the operational cost of the Waymo One fleet, including the sensor maintenance and remote monitoring infrastructure, is still high enough that the path to profitability requires either dramatically higher pricing than Uber, or a volume threshold that requires much faster geographic expansion than they've achieved so far.
Several HN commenters who work in transportation noted that Dallas is also strategically interesting because it's one of the highest volume rideshare markets in the country and has a relatively permissive regulatory environment for autonomous vehicles. Waymo is essentially using it as a proving ground for the operational model they need to demonstrate before they can make a serious push into other Tier 1 markets.
The comments were also full of firsthand accounts from people who'd ridden Waymo in San Francisco and Phoenix, and the sentiment was remarkably consistent, technically impressive, but the experience of not having a human available when something ambiguous happens is genuinely disorienting in a way that takes time to get used to.
Which is itself a kind of data. The technology question and the human factors question are separate, and both matter for adoption curves.
The city of Dallas has apparently provided some infrastructure coordination support, which is notable. That kind of municipal cooperation signals regulatory tailwind that Waymo's competitors won't easily replicate.